Welcome back to the lab. So sources have been removed from this recording for compatibility with listening. Visit quantumdisciple.com to view the sources in detail. To the children of Israel, the people of the book, and my own flesh and blood, I write this presentation as a son of the tribe. I am Ashkenazi, born of the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. While I was not raised in a strictly observant household, the rhythm of our people, the logic of the Talmud, and the melody of the Kol Nidre is in my DNA. I love the Torah. It is the ethical bedrock of Western civilization. But as a researcher, I have to look at our systems honestly. And when I look at modern Judaism, I see a disconnect. We are a people who cherish the Torah, yet we are following a system that looks nothing like the one Moses gave us. The engine has been swapped out, and most of us never asked when or why. I am not asking you to leave your Jewish identity. I am asking you to reclaim the full picture of it. Quote, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. End quote. Section 1.0, the logical dilemma, the broken altar. To understand the crisis, we have to look at the contract of the Torah. The law of Moses was not just a philosophy, it was a legal agreement with specific mechanisms. Look at the central equation. The Torah is explicit about how human error or sin is processed. Quote, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. End quote. Notice the constraint. Crucially, God added a restriction. You could not just offer a sacrifice in your backyard. It had to be done only at the place the Lord will choose. That meant the temple in Jerusalem. The logic is simple. You need blood to fix the sin. You need the temple to offer the blood. Section 1.1, the catastrophe. In the year 70, the Roman general Titus breached Jerusalem. The ancient historian Josephus records the exact moment the daily sacrifice ceased. He notes that on the 17th of Tammuz, the priests ran out of lambs, and for the first time in centuries, the smoke on the altar stopped. Days later, the temple was burned to the ground. The implication is profound. This wasn't just a tragedy, it was a theological catastrophe. The mechanism required to fulfill the law was destroyed. Legally, this left the Jewish people in a state of breach of contract. The Torah demands a sacrifice, but history has made that sacrifice impossible. Section 1.2, the transition window. This leads to a critical question. Would God allow his only authorized interface, the temple, to be destroyed without establishing a replacement first? In Jewish theology, there is a principle that God always prepares the cure before he allows the wound. If the temple was the wound, where was the cure? The historical data shows a precise 40-year transition window. Around the year 30, Jesus of Nazareth establishes a new covenant at his Last Supper, claiming his blood is the new atonement. By the year 70, the Romans destroy the physical temple, ending the old atonement system forever. Look at the pre-announcement. Centuries before this happened, the Hebrew scriptures explicitly stated that the old system, the Mosaic covenant, was not permanent. It had an expiration date. God promised that a new system was coming to replace it. Quote, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt. End quote. Consider the verification data or the upgrade. The prophet Jeremiah didn't just predict a different covenant, he predicted a superior one. He detailed exactly how the features would change. First, an internal change. Quote, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. End quote. The old system was external stone tablets. The new system is internal transformation of the heart. Second, permanent forgiveness. Quote, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. End quote. The old system required yearly reminders of sin on Yom Kippur. The new system promises total erasure. The logical conclusion is this. Therefore, the destruction of the temple in the year 70 was the physical confirmation that the old system had been archived. This happened because the upgrade predicted by Jeremiah and inaugurated by the Messiah was now active. The inability to fulfill the Torah today is not a failure of God. It is the evidence that he kept his promise. Part 2, Section 2.0. The pivot, the Council of Jamnia. Today, if you ask a rabbi how we are forgiven without a temple, they will tell you that prayer, repentance, and charity have replaced the sacrifice. But we must ask, when did that rule change? It is not in the Torah. Section 2.1. Crisis management. After the temple fell, the Jewish faith faced extinction. Without the altar, the central mechanism of the religion was gone. A famous leader, Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, established a new center for Jewish life. It was there that the new rules were decided. We actually have the historical record of the moment this shift happened. It is recorded in ancient writings. Quote, "Once, as Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai was coming forth from Jerusalem, Rabbi Joshua followed after him and beheld the temple in ruins. 'Woe unto us,' Rabbi Joshua cried, 'that this, the place where the iniquities of Israel were atoned for, is laid waste.' 'My son,' Rabban Yohanan said to him, 'be not grieved. We have another atonement as effective as this. And what is it? It is acts of loving kindness. As it is said, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice.'" End quote. Section 2.2, the authority problem. This is the turning point of history. In that moment, a human leader declared that good deeds were now equal to the blood atonement commanded by God. The logical conflict is clear. While the rabbi's intention was to save the people from despair, he did not have the authority to rewrite the contract. God said, quote, "The life is in the blood. I have given it to you to make atonement." End quote. The rabbi said, "We have another way." This shifted Judaism from being a biblical faith based on what God said to a rabbinic faith based on what the sages interpreted. We traded the objective requirement of the Torah for the subjective hope that our good deeds would be enough. But nowhere in the Torah does God say that charity can pay the debt of sin. Only life pays for life. Section 3.0, the math problem. The Daniel timeline. Most people think the Messiah could arrive at any random moment in history. But if we look at the Hebrew prophets, that is not true. The Messiah had a specific arrival time. The prophet Daniel, writing from Babylon, gave a specific countdown. He didn't just give a vague era. He started a stopwatch. Section 3.1, the equation. The angel Gabriel gives Daniel the formula. Quote, "From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens," end quote. Let's do the math. The unit of measure in Hebrew prophecy for a seven is a period of 7 years. The duration is 7 plus 62, which equals 69 sets of 7 years. The total is 69 times seven, which equals 483 years. The prophecy states that from the command to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, there would be exactly 483 years until the Messiah appeared. Section 3.2. The calculation to the day. We know from historical records that the command to rebuild the walls was given by the Persian king Artaxerxes on March 14th in the year 445 before Christ. However, the biblical prophetic calendar uses a 360-day year, not our standard solar year. 483 years multiplied by 360 days equals 173,880 days. If you start at March 14th, 445 before Christ, and count forward exactly that number of days, you arrive at April 6th in the year 32. What happened on that exact date? This was the 10th of Nisan, the very day the Passover lamb was selected. It was the day Jesus rode a donkey into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. For the first time in his ministry, He allowed the crowds to hail him as king. He fulfilled the timeline to the exact day. The mathematical summary is this. Daniel predicted the Messiah would arrive 483 biblical years after the command to rebuild Jerusalem. The start date was in the year 445. The duration was 173,880 days. The arrival date was in the year 32. This is not a vague guess. It is a mathematical lock to the specific era and arguably the specific week of Jesus's passion. Section 3.3, the summary of facts. Rather than interpreting the data, we can simply look at the chronological constraints established by the text and history. Constraint A is the timeline. Daniel predicted a specific period between the command to rebuild Jerusalem and the arrival of the Messiah. Counting forward places the arrival in the early first century. Constraint B is the hard stop. The text explicitly states that the Messiah must arrive and be killed before the destruction of the temple. Quote, after the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. End quote. Constraint C is the historical event. The city and sanctuary were destroyed by Titus in the year 70. Constraint D is the rabbinic reaction. The Talmud records a harsh reaction to those who attempt to calculate these specific dates. Quote, blasted be the bones of those who calculate the end, end quote. The decision is clear. The ancient prophecy is not open-ended. It has a built-in expiration date. The text requires the Messiah to appear before the Roman fires burn the temple. This leaves a historical binary. Either the window closed in the year 70 without a Messiah, leaving the prophecy unfulfilled, or the Messiah arrived within the window exactly as predicted, but was not recognized at the time. Part 3, Section 4.0. The hostile witness, the Talmudic omens. This is the most fascinating piece of data I have found. It doesn't come from the New Testament. It comes from the Babylonian Talmud, the central text of rabbinic Judaism. The Talmud records that during the 40 years before the destruction of the temple, specific omens or anomalies occurred in the sanctuary. To understand why this matters, you have to understand the baseline protocol. Section 4.1, the public monitor. On Yom Kippur, the high priest performed the scapegoat ritual. He would take a strip of crimson wool and divide it. Piece A was tied to the horns of the scapegoat, which was sent into the wilderness to carry the sins away. Piece B was tied to the door of the sanctuary. The piece on the door served as the public monitor. It was the national status light. Based on the ancient promise, though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. The expectation was that at the moment the goat was pushed off the cliff in the desert, signaling the sins were gone, the wool on the temple door would miraculously bleach white. Section 4.2. The audit. Was it a trick? A skeptic might ask if the priest just dipped it in bleach or if it was a chemical trick to control the masses. We have to look at the motive and the chemistry. The chemistry problem is that in the ancient world, bleaching wool was a slow process. It involved soaking fabric in lye, sulfur fumes, or leaving it in the intense sun for days. The Talmud describes a phenomenon that happened in real time, at the moment the goat was pushed in the wilderness. There was no known chemical agent in the first century that could instantly turn crimson wool snow white in front of a crowd without destroying the fabric. The motive problem is the smoking gun. This is the strongest logical proof. If the high priests were faking the miracle to keep the people happy, why did they stop faking it for the last 40 years? The priests in the first century were corrupt politicians. They wanted to maintain order. It would have been in their best interest to keep faking the miracle so the public would believe God was still happy with the temple. By admitting that the thread stayed red for 40 years, they were admitting that they had lost their connection with God. This was a public relations nightmare. logic dictates that corrupt leaders fake success, not failure. The fact that they recorded their own failure for four decades suggests they were witnessing a phenomenon they could not control and could not fake. Section 4.3, the history of the signal. The Talmud gives us a performance report of this miracle over three distinct eras. Era one was the Golden Age, approximately 200 years before Christ. This era corresponds to the priesthood of Simon the Just. Simon was a giant of history. He was the high priest and the last survivor of the Great Assembly. The Talmud records that his piety was so great that during his 40-year tenure, the crimson thread turned white every single year. A statistical note, in a random system, the mathematical odds of getting the same result 40 times in a row are approximately 1 in a trillion. This streak of favor was statistically impossible without supernatural intervention. Era two was the fluctuating age. After Simon died, the spiritual state of the nation declined. The miracle became inconsistent. The Talmud says, sometimes it turned white and sometimes it remained red. The signal was glitchy, depending on the merit of the current high priest. Era three was the hard stop. Then the pattern changed drastically. The sages record, quote, our rabbis taught during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the crimson thread did not turn white, end quote. The logical conclusion is that this wasn't a fluctuation anymore. It was another statistical impossibility, 40 consecutive years of red. The math is simple. The year 70, the year of destruction, minus 40 years lands exactly on the year 30. The event is clear. The year 30 is the year Jesus was crucified. According to the Talmud, the moment Jesus died, the old system stopped validating the animal sacrifices. The red thread stayed red because the final scapegoat, the Messiah, had already carried the sins away once and for all. Part 4, Section 5.0. The identity crisis, the two profiles. Why did our ancestors miss him? In the first century, the Jewish world was under Roman occupation. The people were desperate for a conquering king to crush Rome. They focused entirely on the prophecies of glory and ignored the prophecies of suffering. But if we look at the data honestly, the Hebrew prophets describe two completely different profiles. Section 5.1, the contradictory data. The scriptures present a paradox that has puzzled scholars for centuries. Profile A is the suffering servant. The prophets described a humble figure who arrives quietly and dies for the sins of the nation. Quote, rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. I see your king comes to you righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey. End quote. Quote, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And by his wounds, we are healed, end quote. Profile B is the conquering king. The prophets also described a warrior who arrives from heaven to defeat Israel's enemies and rule the world. Quote, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power, end quote. Section 5.2. The rabbinic struggle. The tension between these two profiles is undeniable. How can the Messiah be a dying servant and an eternal king? Later rabbinic tradition realized this contradiction was so sharp that they developed a theory of two messiahs. The first was Messiah, son of Joseph, who suffers and dies in battle. The second was Messiah, son of David, who rules and reigns. The Talmud explicitly discusses this mourning for the suffering Messiah. Quote, the verse is interpreted as a eulogy for Messiah, son of Joseph, who is killed. End quote. The sages saw the data required a death. They just assumed it had to be a different person. Section 5.3. The logical solution. The two peaks. There is a simpler solution. It is not two different messiahs. It is one messiah with two arrivals. Imagine standing on a plain and looking at a mountain range. You see two massive peaks that look like they are right next to each other. But if you hike to the first peak, you would realize there is a massive valley. a long span of time, separating it from the second peak. The prophets saw the events, the suffering and the reigning, but they couldn't see the timeline separating them. Arrival 1 occurred in the first century. Jesus came as the suffering servant to deal with the internal problem, sin. He rode the donkey, but he also fulfilled the grim prediction that the anointed one will be put to death and will have nothing. The original Hebrew word used here is a technical term often used in the Torah for the death penalty or violent excision. He didn't just die, he was executed to pay the debt. Arrival 2 is in the future. He will return as the conquering king to deal with the external problem, evil and war. He will arrive on the clouds to rule. Section 5.4, the modern shift. You may be wondering, if the two Messiah theory is in the Talmud, why have I never heard it in synagogue? Following the rise of Christianity and the failed revolt of a false Messiah in the second century, the Jewish leadership made a strategic theological shift to clearly distinguish Judaism from the growing Christian movement. The concept of a dying Messiah was de-emphasized and eventually moved to the fringes of Jewish thought. Today, mainstream Judaism primarily focuses on the conquering king, or interprets the suffering servant passages not as an individual, but as the nation of Israel suffering for the world. In many modern circles, the belief in a personal Messiah has been replaced entirely by the concept of a messianic age, a time of peace and human progress achieved through our own efforts. This leaves the modern reader with a choice. We can accept the modern reinterpretation that removes the suffering individual, or we can look back at the original data, which describes a specific person who dies before the Second Temple falls. Section 6.0. Conclusion, the anchor. I understand the hesitation. For a Jewish person to consider Jesus, it often feels like betrayal. It feels like leaving the tribe to join the other team. But if we set aside the emotions and look strictly at the data stack, a clear picture emerges. We have two independent lines of evidence, one from the prophets and one from the Talmud, that converge on the exact same moment in history. Look at the math of the timeline. The prophet Daniel started a countdown of 483 years from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. History records two major decrees issued by the Persian king. Exhibit A is the first decree. It restored the judicial and religious authority of Jerusalem, restoring the city as a governing capital. Counting forward from this date lands at the start of Jesus's ministry and his baptism. Exhibit B is the second decree. It authorized the physical reconstruction of the walls and gates. Counting forward from this date lands at the triumphal entry and Palm Sunday. The verdict is that regardless of which decree you believe fits the text better, the countdown expires in the exact same narrow window. The math lands squarely on the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Look at the hostile witness of the Talmud. Our own sages recorded that the Yom Kippur miracle, the crimson thread turning white, stopped working 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The year 70 minus 40 years lands us in the year 30. Whether the specific year was 30, 32, or 33, both our prophecy and our oral tradition agree that the old system expired and the Messiah event occurred in that specific window. Look at the profile of the suffering servant. While we expected a conquering king, the prophets also described a suffering servant, predicting he would be pierced for our transgressions and put to death. The data requires a Messiah who dies to pay a debt, not just a king who rules. Look at the promise of the new covenant. The prophet explicitly predicted that the Mosaic covenant on stone was never meant to be permanent. Quote, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people." End quote. God promised a specific shift. He would move the law from external tablets to the human heart, and offer permanent forgiveness. Here's the invitation. I don't expect you to accept all of this at once. This is a heavy presentation and it challenges centuries of tradition, but I do invite you to audit the data. Don't take my word for it. Open your own scriptures. Calculate the timeline. Open the Talmud and read it for yourself. Read the prophets without the commentary and ask who it describes. If these claims are false, they will crumble under scrutiny. But if they are true, then the Messiah is not a stranger or a traitor. He is the specific solution our prophets promised, arriving exactly on time. The evidence is on the table. The conclusion is yours to draw. The altar is cold, but the Lamb is alive. Thank you for listening. Please like and subscribe and visit quantumdisciple.com for more Christian research. Quantum Disciple out.